This is an encore presentation of Unreserved. Enjoy. Danse, Anine, Bujou. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. They were once part of indigenous cultures all over the world. In the subarctic, the Inuit called them Kakanit. On the other side of the world, the Maori called it Tamoko. And many nations in between inked their faces and bodies. Tattoos that conveyed a person's identity, history, and connections to their culture. Colonization erased those traditional markings for generations. But now, artists and activists are leading a resurgence. Today on Radio Indigenous, redrawing the line to culture through traditional tattoos. If you turn on the TV in Aotearoa, also known as New Zealand, you'll see more Maori skin markings than ever before. Last December, journalist Aurini Kaipara made international headlines and historic strides for Maori representation. Kaipara became the country's first primetime news anchor to wear moko kawai, which color most of the chin and lips. In an interview with ABC News Australia, she explains that it has spiritual significance.
It's more than just ink on one skin. It's a birthright for Maori women. This is my language, this is my heritage, this is my ancestry, and this is my mother, my sisters, my daughters. I don't just see myself in the reflection, I see other women, Maori women especially, who have undertaken the role and the responsibility of being a moko kawai wearer, and there are hundreds of us, if not thousands.
One of those thousands of women even stands on the international stage.
Nanaia Mahuta will become our Minister of Foreign Affairs.
In 2020, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern promoted MP Nanaia Mahuta. Not only is Mahuta the first woman to be Minister of Foreign Affairs, girl power, she's the first Maori politician to wear moko kawai in the country's parliament. Seeing Maori culture in the mainstream is a dream come true for Julie Pa'ama Pingeli. Julie is a Maori activist and artist who's helped lead the resurgence of traditional skin markings, or ta moko, since the 1990s. But she's concerned there may be a downside to that hard-won popularity. Julie joined us from Aotearoa. Tanse Julie Anin.
Kia ora, morena. I say morena because it's morning in Aotearoa.
Ah, yes, you're a day ahead of us. You're in the future.
We're in the future.
Now, Maori chin markings are quite different from those that Inuit here or First Nations people here on Turtle Island wear. You know, Inuit will often have multiple lines or dashes on their chin or on their forehead and, you know, other parts of their bodies, while Cree and Anishinaabe people will have a simple line from lip to chin or along the eye line or on the cheeks. So for our listeners who may not know what a moko kawai looks like, can you describe what they are?
I guess it's a little bit similar, but it's also a little bit more complex. So within the Maori design, the pattern moves between the positive and the negative. So the space is actually the pattern, and it usually looks like a couple of sort of swirl seed head type designs. That's the space. And then the lines constitute, you know, the framing of that space. And there's many different versions of what it actually represents. So it's two figures that are actually protecting the female and her voice and her purpose. Design-wise, it's a complex interaction between space and line. Possibly for many Indigenous cultures, it's not just the line that's indicative of the purpose. It's the space in between or between as well.
Yes. So it's not just what's there, it's also what's not there.
What's left.
What's left.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how common was it to see tamoko when you were growing up?
I didn't really see much at all. I mean, mostly while I was growing up, versions of our moko we'd see on people on bikes, you know, motorcyclists, gangs. It kind of moved underground for a long time. And really the reclamation of it started with Māori who were looking for ways to belong again as a tribe, as a people, and in prisons, you know, people were searching for their identity. And so it kind of, the momentum started in that way. And then it became more of a movement, particularly after 1990. And artists and I guess artists that were politically activating and people, language experts and other cultural experts were starting to amass and communicate with each other about, you know, the possibilities of revival.
Mm-hmm. What's the historical backstory with that? Why did the tamoko disappear from your faces?
Largely to the colonizers, to the British colonizers and others, the missionaries that came and realized fairly quickly that if they were to convert Māori from heathenism into civilized, you know, versions of Westerners, then they had to break down their gods, their atua, we call them, their belief systems. And of course, the marking of the body was seen as quite a visible claim to identity and the underlying belief. And one of the most powerful things that the government did was in 1907, they passed the Tohunga Suppression Act, and that banned our tohunga, our experts, at practicing anything. That included medicine, carving, you know, anything that could be considered expert practice. And as we headed into mid-90s, and, you know, civilization meant letting go of our language, moving into cities, getting jobs, all those sorts of things. They just dealt blow after blow to our visual language, particularly the male face, you know, because it historically was associated with warriorhood, which isn't, you know, classically what its purpose was, but because Māori resisted, because they were fighting the Europeans and they had their faces tattooed, they were, you know, they were labeled as, it was labeled as a warrior expression.
Right.
Really, the woman's kowai was really the last thing to visually exist, because I guess woman and that particular piece on the face was seen as less of a visual challenge.
Well, that story sounds very familiar. Colonialization.
Yes. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And getting back to the tamoko, and I know this is a very complex question, but how would you describe the significance of tamoko?
For us, moko represents our mediation with the world. It represents our mediation with the atua, we call them, the deities that guide and have guardianship over every single facet of our world, of every individual part of our world that gifts us with the things that keep us alive. Moko has a complex symbolic language that represents that mediation between the person that walks the material world with the immaterial and the spiritual world. So that positive and negative that balances out in our design represents that the world, te ao marama that we live in, engaged with the world of the universe that surrounds us and all the spirits in it. So when we take on moko, it's not simply a marking, and the process indicates that, the process between the artist, the person, and their whakapapa or their genealogy and their story is manifest in their moko, no matter what the moko. Those are all things that intersect with that big universe that we all whakapapa to as Māori. So when we apply moko onto our skin, it's a manifestation of the universe inside us. As we walk this world, our learning becomes manifest, our journey becomes manifest on our skin. That's the way I see it.
Because you're wearing it right there, your history, your knowledge, your name even, your connection to each other. And somebody who spent decades working to change perceptions around moko, what would you say eventually tipped the scales and helped more Maori people to become comfortable receiving the markings?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. With the revival, it just kept going forward and growing and growing. And as that grew to a critical mass, and to be honest, things like the face, as they became highly politicized, like, you know, the non-Māori wearing the chin moko, people started to question themselves and say, well, why isn't it me? What's holding me back? Mm. You know, why aren't I doing that? And then particularly women's kauai, it just gained this huge momentum, and where women, you know, came and said, you know, this is what I need to do for the future of my children, to assert their identity as Māori.
Mm. You mentioned non-Māori getting the moko. What are your thoughts on non-Māori people seeking the traditional designs?
I don't have much tolerance of it, no matter. At this particular point, I mean, I think it's kind of a political context. It's not a never, ever, ever question. When I started doing moko, you know, I wouldn't do any non-Māori, any moko, because for me, it had to belong with our communities first. And if our communities had barriers like financial and confidence and health and all those things, and they couldn't claim it as part of their well-being, then it didn't belong with non-Māori. That would just oppress us more. But as things have moved on politically and as our work has been appropriated quite prolifically overseas, it's become important that we are the agents for doing our own work, because that's the only way people are actually going to understand the importance of it and the difference. In terms of the face, the kauai, the moko on the face, and also the significant one on the buttocks and legs, which represents our entire whakapapa or genealogy, I feel they're taboo. You know, once we start entering that, you know, arguments about who's entitled and, oh, they've got Māori children and all those sorts of things, you know, I think we've started to say it's for everybody.
Mm. So are you saying that you now give non-Māori people the moko, the tamoko?
I do give non-Māori moko, but never the significant ones. Like, it wouldn't be a whole sleeve or something like that. Does that signify, you know, our identity exclusively?
So where do you draw the line? You mentioned that you'll give them something of an identity of themselves, but you don't want to give them, you mentioned the body tattoos on the buttocks and on the legs. Why is the line drawn there?
Because the, these are the ones that are significant to us. Mm-hmm. So the facial ones, you know, they represent particular roles and identify as Māori. So you need to be able to assert, you know, your Māori identity through those. You need to understand that and be able to defend, you know, the wearing of that. It's not just something that looks good.
Yeah.
And then the one on the buttocks and legs, that is our whole genealogy. That's a single person's genealogy. That one is handed down from our ancestors, you know, from Hawaiki. It's traveled with us for a long, long time. The people that come for moko, they haven't traveled with us on that journey.
So what kind of conversations do you have with people before you will give them a moko?
I'll talk to them about where and where is appropriate and why. Who they want to represent is important, like their parents, their brothers, sisters. They might be the core composition because it's a whakapapa relationship. Those are the people they take with them and or their children, and why they've been led to moko, what's their connection, what is their spirit of love for Māori and for Aotearoa. And something sometimes where they're from, finding a connection to their own spirit.
So there's a bit of a getting to know you section of the of the process, right?
Yeah, no two pieces are the same.
Yeah,
even if two people come in and say we're two sisters, they're not the same piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. when you're having conversations with other practitioners, what kinds of conversations are you having about keeping these to just Maori, or for becoming over popular or trivialized or appropriated?
We have conversations around the language and providing new and relevant language. For example, I'm not a fan of the word kiritohi. Kiritohi grew to be a word to represent non-Māori getting designs. There's non-Māori that say they do kiritohi as tattooists. And so there's a whole hotbed of like politic around this word kiritohi, and can non-Māori be an artist, you know?
Right.
And once again, for me, it's like, well, if I do a design on someone, it's moko. I'm not going to do some shit design and say it's something else, you know? Now, someone who's a non-Māori that picks up machine and someone showed them how to do some Māori design and they go on, oh, I'm a kiritohi artist and blah, blah, blah. They're just faking it, you know? They don't have any resonance with our community. It's not an ongoing learning for them. It's just some use of our design.
Yeah.
So these are the types of issues that we do. We have had opportunities to get together and learn techniques, learn the politics, learn about appropriation and why standing up for ourselves is important. Like, I find the women are really vocal at that because they're used to being marginalized. And so they're really good at standing their ground. And what we ask sometimes is that men don't just go, oh, wow, I'm doing something cool and pretty. Actually stand people out and say, what are you doing?
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to get a little more personal about, you know, what you wear on your body and on your face. You also wear a moko kawai, the traditional chin markings. But I understand you only just got that a few years ago in your 50s. What made you feel ready? What did you feel ready to receive moko kawai when you did?
Oh, you know, I did drag my feet for many years because I have my mother's tradition is British. She's a settler. You know, her family is settlers. And she's, you know, doesn't really understand. And I lost my father when I was quite young, so she's not constantly challenged on that. I'm the only challenge in terms of Māori culture. Also, I have many peers that didn't wear these significant moko. We would like to wear it, but we also think that our auntie or our nana or these other people on the marae need to accept it before we wear it. That's the narrative that goes on in our own heads. Like, how can we bring this to a healthy place at our own area? And then we feel that we can put it on ourselves. And so I withheld doing that, even though some people that I respect that are revivalists and other Indigenous cultures have said, you need to do it, just like you needed to do moko, even though people didn't approve of a woman doing it. And then the time just appeared right. We organised an Indigenous tattoo gathering to Tahiti, and Tahiti is considered the kind of dispersion place for many of our forebears, for Māori, for different areas right throughout the Polynesian Triangle. And so our ancestry links directly to Tahiti. So I organised a contingent of 30, and within that there was a large number of women moko artists, and you know, that was significant in itself because I practiced as the lone woman for a long, long time. And as I thought about it, and the fact that my daughter was coming, and the artist that I had chosen to do my moko was lived in Australia, he was coming, I just thought it seemed appropriate to get my kowai done in a different forum. You know, one in which it was the artist that had supported me, and it seemed like an appropriate place to do it. And so I had it done on Mordia in Tahiti.
And as you were getting your kowai, what were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Oh, it's pretty overwhelming, actually. And then the transformation when you've got it is also very overwhelming. It's like all that intergenerational mamai or pain that we call it is lifted, you know. It's like a relief that you can be who you are, no matter what, you know. You don't even actually get up and think of challenges. You just think, I can let all that go. yeah, it's quite powerful.
And when you looked at it in the mirror, what, how did you react to it?
Well, I didn't really look at it for a while. I just looked at everybody else. but yeah, I guess it's just like it's always been there. You know, I wasn't even cognizant when I got back into town that I had it, you know? And for a lot of people, they didn't actually think about it either. Oh, that's right. You got that done, you know? it just becomes a manifestation of what people actually probably saw there all along.
Oh, that's interesting to me because I've heard that from other people that we've talked to about their, you know, their face tattoos, that it just always felt like it was there. But you said something that was interesting to me. It was like you could let go of all that pain. Suddenly you weren't carrying it anymore. Why did getting your moko do that for you?
I guess, you know, as Māori, all of us hold, and this is something that maybe non-Māori mainstream don't understand, is that we hold more anxieties than the average person, you know. We're anxious over all of our practices and how they're received. So whatever we do has an element of risk and trepidation. And I just feel that when you actually make that move to physically say stuff that, you know, go to hell, all of that, then there's this huge lifting of weight. And an acceptance that you've actually just embraced all that, and it's you can live it fresh, you know, as the Māori that you claim to be, and whatever that, however people want to see that, but now they see it.
Yeah,
there's no mistaking it.
How has getting your moko kauai changed the way you feel about yourself since?
I'm not sure because I was always a fairly vocal person. I don't think it's really changed very much. But I think the important thing is it's changed for my family, you know, for my kids, for the way they feel more comfortable in their Māoriness, whatever that is, you know, whether they embrace parts of it or not, that's who they are, and they can see that really distinctly. They don't need to hide behind that because their mother doesn't. You're actually educating every day. You're in the process of educating people if you wear something on your face.
Well, thank you so much for sharing a bit of your journey with us.
You are welcome. It was a pleasure.
You can ask them in. Julie Pa'ama Pingeli is a Māori tattoo artist who helped lead the way for the Tā Moko resurgence in Aotearoa. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. On the show today, Inkdigenous, the return to traditional tattooing. And while Māori reclamation is well underway in Aotearoa, here on Turtle Island, the journey is relatively new. An Inuk politician received what she calls traditionally inspired tattoos while in office. Former Nunavut MP Mumulakagak was the first to wear the markings on Parliament Hill here in Canada. She told CTV News that at a moment when her life felt like a whirlwind, the markings helped ground her.
So when I got my face tattoos, it was a really important thing to me that I was more comfortable in my own skin, comfortable with reclaiming my culture and language and revitalizing practices that were meant to be eliminated. It's important for individuals to have that understanding of history for Inuit and for Indigenous people across Canada. And it makes me have a better understanding of who I am as an Inuk and as a human being.
Mumulakagak did not seek re-election in 2021, but she continues to advocate for Inuit and residential school survivors. Later in the show, we'll hear from an Inuk artist who recently learned the art of hand-poke tattooing. But before we get there, we gotta visit a good friend in Anishinaabe territory. His name is Isaac Murdoch, and he has a beautiful story about his tattoo journey. As well as being an artist, language speaker, and cultural knowledge keeper, Isaac is also a musician. I think he just woke up one morning and decided, I think I'll make some music now. This track is about healing from intergenerational trauma. Here is Isaac Murdoch in collaboration with singer-songwriter Matt Epp with Indian Song.
You see me on the corner, sitting on 22nd Street. Do you have a couple quarters? It'll make you feel so complete. As I sit on my cardboard box, as the cold wind blows, I keep on hearing voices, they're yapping all day long. I wish they'd stop and listen and just sing my favorite songs. Some good old-fashioned powwow Indian song. Mother, I need you to know that I miss you. And Father, I wonder if you're still there. My medication's on vacation, and my mind, it keeps on racing, leaving me nowhere to go. My Indian song. Thunderbird is going to come down and pick me up and take me back to my homelands. And once I'm there, I'm going to start searching for that sacred medicine. And that sacred medicine is going to search for me. And once we are united, we're going to cast this all across the earth for you and your people, so that you too can be well, so that you too can be healed. Hello, my name is the man who paints the rocks. I come from the village where the serpents are painted on the rocks. I'm from the Pikefish clan, and I live at Nimkiajbikong, which means Thunder Mountain, and I'm really happy to be able to speak with you. I started my tattoo journey quite a few years ago. I remember seeing my grandmother and others in my village that had a dot, a little circle tattooed inside of their arm. My grandmother called it Ojaswani, which meant a medicine mark. Apparently, they were tattooed when they were younger to protect themselves from a bad thing that was going to happen to them. And so the tattoo was a symbol of protection and strength. And so that was my very first kind of experience into it. But as I got older, I became so fascinated with Ojibwe symbolism and what that meant. My Anishinaabe name, Mazanapkingeagoanabe, it means the man who paints the rocks. And so part of that learning of trying to understand what my name was is to learn the symbolism. And that kind of led from learning about pictograph symbology to, you know, Ojibwe pictography on birch bark scrolls. And then, of course, it led into the traditional markings of tattooing. In our language, we call it Ojasawin. And it's such a fascinating topic, because when you just even look at the word Ojasawin, it means the power of blue or green, which is the color of the tattoos. And there's also a tree called Ojasawinatik, which means the tattooing tree. And so, you know, our people believe that, you know, the ashes or coals that are made from sacred fires, these fires are connected directly to the power of the sun. We believe all the fires are connected to the sun. And that when we take these coals and we make the soot out of them and make the ink, that we're taking the power of the sun and we're putting it directly into our bodies and into our skin. And the sun doesn't take a step back. The sun just rises and it keeps going forward. And so tattoos are a symbol of moving forward with strength and integrity and dignity. The symbology that people use for tattoos are very personal and they're very sacred to them. I have 17 tattoos on my body. In the Ojibwe language, we'd call that Muzanin. I have what's called the Muzanin. I have a sacred story that was painted on my body forever. I have three thunderbirds shooting down the bottom of my face. They're on my right side, starting from my hairline all the way down to my cheekbone. And these thunderbirds are coming down. And then on my body, I have a great thunderbird that's, you know, casting lightning. There's lightning on my body. And there's also serpents that are climbing up. And so there's a collage of images on my body that are directly related to the story. It's a story that I learned when I was young. It's a prophecy story that connects the past into the future. You know, I really believe in that story because my father was very, very big on sharing that story with me many times. And it's a story of the thunderbirds and the serpents and a battle that they had and how these baby thunderbirds are going to hatch in the future and help cleanse the earth. And so it was a very, very beautiful story about how our people are going to be going back to the land and returning back to the old way of life. And so it was through dreams and those types of things where I was kind of guided to the process of getting these tattoos. The story is called Atsukan, which means it's a spirit that's being displayed. So Atsukan is very spiritual. You have to have ceremony to talk about those things and to talk about that story, to give it that respect and that integrity that it deserves. That's why tattoos are so cool. Tattoos are really cool because they create space for our ceremonies that normally wouldn't be there. And so the sacred story that's on my body, that has been permanently painted on my body, it's given me a path. It's given me a way of life. And it's given me something to look forward to. For me, it's a spiritual journey. It all has to do with spirit. And the spirit of those markings, of those pictures, are alive. You know, so we feast, we put plates of food in the bush for our symbols that are on our body, to nourish them, to keep them fed, to acknowledge them, so that these birds will always fly high. They'll always fly proud. And when people look at me, well, they're gonna know. That's one serious Indian right there. For years and years, our stories were banned. They were outlawed because our stories were always revolutionary. They were always about going back to the land and reclaiming our spot back in our territories where we come from. Our stories were always about hope and about, you know, reclaiming who we are as Indigenous people and remaining on that sacred path. And because there was such a removal of this knowledge on purpose by the Canadian government, it feels good to actually wear this on our bodies. And it's just a beautiful feeling to walk into society to say, hey, I'm Indigenous. I have Indigenous tattoos. Look, they tell a story. We're still here. We survived. Our story survived. And guess what? Our kids are going to survive too.
Isaac Murdoch is from Serpent River First Nation. We reached him in Nimki Ajibikong, a cultural revitalization camp north of Elliott Lake, Ontario. You can see his tattoos and others on our website, cbc.ca/unreserved. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. Today, inking your cultural history on your skin. Coming up on Unreserved, you'll meet Aidan Corey, an Inuk who learned the hand-poke style of tattooing and then applied some to their own face. Taking us there, Kelly Fraser was an Inuk singer-songwriter from Igloolik, Nunavut. Her powerful music combines Inuktitut and pop. Here's Kelly with Fight for the Rights.
Fight for the rights, for the rights of our people. Fight for the rights of our people. For our people, for our future people. Una new vi adu vila new vi lak to me. Una new vi adu vila new vi lak to me. Whoa. Ila new vagu. Sivuli new vagu. Sumu nuna new vagu. New vata gera sokida. Sumu tema runa yuremada. Whoa. Nirwala kuti mina new. Agalutini ruangluti sana inu gayununa inu silimanu nabu amisuni kaunini tamani lertu sumuga somata tu kising ilanga haima rumang ilanga sumute meiga somata kingulibu sugaraktui. Fight for the rights of our people. For the rights of our people. For our people, for our future people. Fight for the rights of our people. Fight for the rights of our people. For our people, for our future people. I know in Nunavu we need a lot of things. How come we do this when we don't know what it could bring? Rich men want honey and buy our land. They're the ones with money who know they can. We don't even have enough money to compete. Barely have enough food to eat. I'll fight for my land and I won't back down. We can't take it back next time around. They make money off of our needs. Our culture is the one that bleeds. The animals won't recover from from the mind. Our land will become the scene of a crime. Then we're left with nothing left to die. So here I am asking, asking you why. For the rights of our people, fight for the rights of our people, for our people, for our future people.
That's Kelly Fraser, who tragically passed in 2019, but her strong voice and spirit remain. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we're talking to Indigenous people who have led the fight to reclaim traditional tattoos. Before the pandemic, when Aiden Corey looked in the mirror, the young Inuk saw big brown eyes and lightly freckled skin, except for a straight line down the middle of their chin, a traditional Inuit tattoo, or tunit. Today, Aiden sees V-shaped lines down their forehead, pointing to just between their eyebrows, two lines over the bridge of their nose, and a dotted line across each cheek. These are tattoos traditionally worn by Inuit women. And many, like former Nunavut MP Mumulakagak, are reclaiming the ancient tradition. Aiden embodies that resurgence. Welcome, Aiden.
Thank you.
Now, Aiden, let's talk about your beautiful tattoo that you gave yourself on your visage, darling, your visage, your face. Tell me the story behind that, because it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, so I was in my home community and I had just started my traditional tattooing journey for myself, the learning process. And I had received my chin tattoo prior to all of this and had seen an impact that had on my life and felt that I was ready for maybe even something more. I felt kind of at a crossroads within my life. I had just kind of gone through a breakup and I was figuring myself out on this gender journey that I was on. And it was just this moment where I felt like I could use something to support all of that. And I felt that with all that I knew about tattooing and that that could be the strength that I needed to kind of get through that crossroads. And so I sat at my parents' dining room table and I had all my supplies and I had a mirror set up in front of me and I did my traditional forehead tattoo. It was almost as if the outside world, like I was kind of baffled that the people around me walking back and forth through the kitchen and stuff like that weren't necessarily experiencing the same thing that I was, in the sense that I felt like my life was changing as I was doing this tattoo a little bit, and everything felt normal for everyone else, I'm sure, but it was very much a momentous occasion, I believe.
Yeah. Take me to that moment. What were you feeling? What kind of emotions were you going through?
Because it was the first face tattoo that I had done on myself, I was nervous. But I think those nerves were kind of overshadowed by this feeling of like strong empowerment. With each of my tattoos, I have always felt that I'm kind of coming home to myself and learning more about myself. And I think that's what it felt like when I was doing this tattoo, was like I was getting back another piece that I felt had been missing.
Coming home to yourself. That is a really powerful way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Coming home to yourself. I just want to sit with that moment for a second. I love it. Can you describe the process of getting or giving or, you know, an Inuit tattoo? What kind of technique is involved?
So the technique that I use is called hand poking. So you just use a tattoo needle, like a singular tattoo needle, and that you essentially hand poke it into the skin, used over many layers to make the design stand out. And it's not a painful process. It is a very lengthy process, though. Yeah.
Are you sure, Aiden? I feel like it would hurt to poke yourself in the face with a tiny needle.
It's actually not as bad as I was expecting it to be. Because of the length of the process, it does get a little bit, it does start to hurt a little bit towards the end. And it also depends on where the tattoo is going. I know in several of the tattoos I've done, some people have been like, oh, this is painful. But others have been like, oh, this is nothing, depending on the spots they're getting it done.
Yeah. Did you have any reservations about getting them? I mean, it's on your visage, right? It's right there. So mm-hmm. That might seem like a bold move to some.
Yeah, it definitely felt like it in the moment, or at least prior to the moment. There was definitely some, not hesitation necessarily, but there was some worries, I think, that were there just because of the history of tattoos being banned and then kind of not ever seeing them after that. For me personally, anyways, it did feel like a very big move, and I was worried about how it would impact like things like getting a job or living down south and around people who weren't necessarily familiar with my culture.
Yeah,
there definitely was some factors at play there that I was worried about, but I didn't necessarily let that stop me, you know?
Can you tell the audience, for those that don't know, myself included, what is the cultural significance of these markings?
So traditionally, Inuit women would receive tattoos for many different reasons. Some were for beauty purposes. Others were to mark accomplishments. There was plenty of reasons for why traditionally we did it. And I think now the significance of receiving our traditional tattoos now is kind of like an act of bodily sovereignty. And what I mean when I say that is, for so long, we, through the process of colonization, we weren't allowed to be fully ourselves. And I think reclaiming that is a very important thing to do. And I believe through reclaiming our traditional tattoos, we are also doing that.
Yeah. And when you say you weren't allowed to do it, what disrupted that practice? What do you mean by you weren't allowed?
So through the process of assimilation into Christianity, we essentially, as Inuit, weren't allowed to practice our tattooing because it was banned. It was thought of as evil by the missionaries, and it became somewhat of a hidden practice. So the women who did have their tattoos obviously kept them, but it became kind of an underground practice because it was banned.
Yeah. And that might be surprising to some people to hear. You grew up in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut. How often did you see people with traditional Inuit tattoos?
Not ever, to be honest, until the Tattoo Revitalization Project started. I don't think I had ever seen anyone with traditional tattoos until that moment.
The Inuit Tattoo Revitalization Project was started by Hovag Johnson, an Inuk from Nunavut, about 6 years ago. She noticed the ancient art was on the verge of being erased completely. So she quickly learned the technique of hand poke and set out to revive the tradition. Hovak traveled to communities across the north and visited schools to teach children about the tattoo's cultural significance. She also invited Inuit women to gather and receive their ancestral markings, many for the first time. Aiden attended one of those events in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut, back in 2016.
When I went in to receive my tattoo, it was like walking into another world almost. There was a bunch of women in the space that were getting, also receiving their tattoos. There was an elder drum dancing, and there was like traditional music playing, and there was even like a traditional, I guess, tent in there in the space that they were using to tattoo in as well. And that was actually where I received my tattoo, was within the tent. And it was just a very, like, incredibly special moment.
you also have a personal connection to traditional tattoo. You know someone in your family who has one. Can you tell me about her?
Yeah, of course. So it was said that my great-great-grandmother, Ovilok, who I'm named after, also had her chin tattooed, which was part of the reason why I got my chin tattooed as well. It's believed in Inuit culture that the people we are named after, we take on parts of that person. And I thought it would be very fitting to receive a tattoo that my namesake had also had.
Mm. So you got a tattoo on your chin that mirrored your great-great-grandmother?
Yeah, exactly.
That's so cool. I love that. And what about your decision to pass on those beautiful gifts on for others? Why did you want to pick it up and then pass it on?
I think in my own personal life, I've always had some struggles with my mental health, with connecting to my community, even in some ways, because of those struggles with my mental health. And I believe that trauma is not an individualistic thing. It's a very collective thing within our communities. And by helping to heal yourself, you're also, to some degree, helping to heal others. And I think that's really important on our process towards healing from intergenerational trauma.
That's interesting. What do you mean by that? How does tattooing heal you from intergenerational trauma?
Intergenerational trauma is tricky in the sense that it often makes us feel as if we are not whole mm-hmm. as ourselves. And I think through the process of traditional tattooing, it, again, this act of bodily sovereignty, where it's saying, this is me, this is who I am, this is my body, I am Inuk. And that's a healing process for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily just a process of getting the tattoo. It's a process of like listening to these people's stories and letting them talk about these things and letting them express how they feel. And so it's not just necessarily the process of tattooing itself. It's this process of kind of moving forward into life with a new perspective, or at least with a little less baggage than before, I'd like to think.
Now, your tattoo journey has taken you from seeing hardly any growing up to seeing this real resurgence and being part of it. Where do you think it will go?
You know, I'm not really sure. The future of traditional Inuit tattooing, I'd say, is mainly for me about normalizing our culture within our communities, but also normalizing it within the outside world as well, because I think there's so many people that don't even really know too much about Indigenous cultures, but Inuit specifically. I remember growing up having to kind of explain what it meant to be Inuit to people who didn't necessarily know anything about us.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's this process of normalizing it for ourselves, but also normalizing our culture within the outer world as well.
And that, my dear, is called decolonization.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for spending this time with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Aidan Corey is a newly skilled Inuit tattoo artist from Nunavut. That's all our time this week. This episode was produced by Kata Dack, Aaron Knoll, Kim Kasher, Laura Bone Stubing, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ganaskanamitnawi, Egosay.